My first contact with Jesse Meyer was at the old medical school building at 18th and Locust Street in the third year of my medical school career. The course called Clinical Chemistry and Microscopy was then given by four physicians, young practicing internists, Drs. Albert Taussig, John Salter, and a Dr. Rush who did not remain long in St. Louis, and Jesse Meyer. The class of about 65 was divided into several sections: urinalysis, hematology, and gastroenterology, and met for 2 hours once a week. Jesse Meyer was in charge of the gastroenterology, the segment of internal medicine, which had a special appeal for him. This was before the days of X-ray GI examinations, and diagnosis depended upon history and physical examinations, along with examination of the gastric contents and feces. As students, we were required to learn the technique of passing the then standard 13 millimeter stomach tube, which had been designed by the German gastroenterologist Ewald, who had also established the standard test meal, breakfast of bread and water. We students took turns as patient and physician in passing the stomach tube, thereby obtaining a knowledge of the sensation peculiar to each extremity of the tube in its passage through the esophagus. We were taught the titration method of free and total acidity determination and the determination of lactic acid in the removed stomach contents, an important factor then in establishing a diagnosis of gross gastric retention. Stool examinations, beside the test for blood, was mainly in the realm of recognizing the microscopic appearance of common food residues, and particularly the gross and microscopic appearance of intestinal parasites and ova. Parasitic infection and infestation was an important section of medical practice in those days. Days when plumbing facilities were not as frequent in urban or even, in rural and even in urban regions as at present. At the close of the school year, Dr. Meyer asked me if I cared to spend part of the days of the coming vacation months in his office, an opportunity which I welcomed. During the busy fourth year of clinics, I saw little of Dr. Meyer. Then came a year of internship at the City Hospital in St. Louis. In those days, there was no regular visiting staff at the hospital, The training was by the seniors and residents. But some of us would, from time to time, assemble a list of interesting clinical problems and invite our former teachers at the medical school to make rounds with us. Among the men helping us in this regard were Dr. Liederking, Dr. Washington Fischel, Jesse Meyer, and others. Toward the close of the intern year, Dr. Meyer invited me to put up my shingle at his office and continue to help with his laboratory and clinical work. The former preceptor method of medical teaching had passed, but some of its advantages were still appreciated by the older practitioners and even by the young graduates. Many medical graduates sought associations of this sort as postgraduate training. This and European postgraduate courses were, aside from a few Eastern clinics, the only source of postgraduate training available, and particularly specialty training. Germany and Austria, however, were well organized for such teaching, and I betook myself in April of that year to Europe with introductions from Jesse Meyer to some of the men with whom he had studied some years before. Among these was Dr. Hermann Strauss, the originator of the electrically lighted proctosigmoidoscope. Here in Berlin, I spent the better part of the year, and on my return to the United States in 1908, set up an office of my own in the Lister Building. But most of my time I spent at the office of Dr. Meyer in the Linmar Annex at Washington, just east of Van Deventer. The building is still standing. There I served as assistant in one and another phase of his practice, much of it in laboratory work and history taking, combined with a few hours here and there, a week of house call and hospital calls. Those were horse and buggy days, and hospital visits and house calls took up more time than they do at present. I helped in compiling of literature reviews for Dr. Meyer's section in the Interstate Medical Journal, of which he was an associate editor of the section on internal medicine. This journal was established and edited by Dr. Ball, who later on established the journal of known as Modern Hospital, which still exists. Called attention to the pioneer work of William Beaumont some 75 years before in the field of gastric physiology. And Beaumont, in his later years of life, had been a resident of St. Louis. It came to the attention of Jesse Meyer that Beaumont's daughter, the elderly Mrs. Keim, resided here and was in possession of many of her father's manuscripts. Dr. Meyer approached her with the suggestion of writing a Beaumont biography if the material was available to him, and she showed him two old chests full of yellowing manuscript papers, books, letters, and so forth. We were permitted to transport these, a market basket full at a time, to Dr. Meyer's office. And then he started 2 years of feverish activity, first in learning to decipher the difficult handwriting with its many corrections and interlinings, letters, clinical notebooks, all manner of personal and medical data were transcribed for inclusion in the writing of the biography. He journeyed to the places in New York and in New England where Beaumont had passed the early years of his life and had studied medicine. He consulted the old township records in the various localities in the eastern states in search of biographical data, all with his usual eager and painstaking methods. The results are evident in the completed volume. Tragically enough, in the midst of all this, he became aware of some abatement of energy, a growing fatigue. Search for a cause disclosed that he was suffering from leukemia. A few days after the discovery of the condition by his laboratory technician, he told me about it and of his determination to keep the fact secret, to share it only with the necessary consulting physicians, and to carry on as usual and without informing family or friend. I have never witnessed a more Spartan-like adherence to this determined course of action than in his case. His greatest anxiety was he might not bring the work of biography to completion. And he worked at top speed late into the hot summer nights on the final printer's proofs. His compelling wish and effort was that it should be a worthy and enduring piece of work. The fact that a second printing was brought out in 1939 is a testimony of its enduring worth. Jesse Meyer was born in a small Missouri town, but most of his life was spent in metropolitan St. Louis. Born in the Victorian era, he had a somewhat austere manner and presence, echoing the best phases of that culture. The doctrine of noblesse oblige was one of his ideals, and his last years were a fine witness to that ideal. I often heard him quote, as a guide for good medical practice, the lines of Pope: "Be not the first by whom the new are tried, nor yet the last to lay the old aside." But he was by no means blind to the newer things in medicine. He was quick to adopt the aids which the laboratory was bringing to the practice of medicine. He journeyed to Europe about the year 1909 to study with Killian the use of the esophagoscope, and was, I believe, the first in St. Louis to use the esophagoscope as a diagnostic instrument. As one of the editors of and contributors to the Interstate Medical Journal, he became known outside of St. Louis and was early elected a member of the American Gastroenterological Society. One of his hobbies as a young man was the collection of old furniture, including several canopied beds and also the collection of crystal chandeliers. After his marriage in 1907, these became a feature in the home which he established on Washington Avenue, east of Taylor. He continued in active practice until an acute phase of his leukemia made him take to bed for the final week of life without a wavering in the iron fortitude that had sustained him during the past several years. End. It may be of interest to detail here something of the nature of medical practice at the era around the turn of the century. A more complete picture, however, might be gotten by consulting a copy of the standard textbook of the day, William Osler's Practice of Medicine. This volume opened with a section of about 100 pages on typhoid fever, to be followed by a chapter of almost the same length on tuberculosis and a somewhat briefer one on syphilis. The diseases of lesser importance followed in order, with the many infectious diseases, scarlet fever, rheumatism, measles, etc. Somewhat earlier, Pasteur, Claude Bernard, Lister, Koch, Leffler, Rentgen, and Virchow were among the important figures in the foundation of modern medicine. In gastroenterology, Pavlov's work in Russia was becoming known here, and Ewald, Boas, and Hermann Strauss in Berlin were among the leaders in that specialty. Cannon of Harvard and Meltzer and Einhorn in New York were adding important knowledge in this country, and the possibilities of the X-ray as a diagnostic medium were just dawning on the horizon. During the first few years of the century, the Washington University Medical School had, I believe, only 4 full-time men on the faculty in anatomy, physiology, chemistry, and pathology. All the rest of the teaching was done by part-time volunteers, all of whom were in medical practice of one sort and another. intern training was available to only a smaller percentage of the graduates in medicine, and there were several medical schools in St. Louis that have since passed from the scene. Washington University itself, in the medical department, was an amalgamation of two schools, the old Missouri Medical College and the St. Louis Medical College. And the medical department of St. Louis University had been formed by an amalgamation of the Beaumont Medical School and the Marion Sims College. I think that Dr. Meyer was a graduate of the last named. In addition to these, however, there was the Barnes Medical School College, no connection with the Barnes Hospital of today, the Physicians and Surgeons Medical School, and a so-called eclectic medical school. The city hospital offered the main opportunity for internship. The other hospitals had either no medical intern, no resident staff, or perhaps one man who had just finished his medical course. Laboratory facilities in the hospitals, except the city hospital, were scant or non-existent, and those who practiced in the various hospitals and wished laboratory work done had to collect their own specimens and bring them to the office. Parasitic infections, including malaria, were prominent in the field of diseases. And amoebiasis was one of the infestations frequently seen and often overlooked in practice. The soldiers returning from the Philippine Islands in the several years following the Spanish-American War often brought the infestation with them, and the disease became rather widespread in this country, if in fact it had not existed in a lesser degree before and unrecognized. the therapeutic value of ipecac in its treatment had been established by physicians in India and in Egypt. But the causative factor organism had only very recently been established. The alkaloid emetine was not yet available, and the arsenicals and the present day amoebicides were yet to come. I can recall the difficulty we had in the administration of the ipecac because of its emetic action. Some means had to be found for its administration so that it might bypass the stomach and some pharmacist here or perhaps elsewhere had found that coating the ipecac-filled capsule with melted salol would allow the capsule to bypass the stomach. This was a satisfactory sort of thing when it worked, but occasionally the amount of salol used in the coating was so great that salol poisoning occurred if any protracted treatment with the ipecac was being carried through. Because of this danger, Dr. Meyer would try to make his own ipecac salol coated capsules so that he might know that a minimum amount of salol was used in their preparation. As I have mentioned, internships were rare in proportion to the number of graduates that were being turned out by the medical schools, and there was considerable competition for the available positions. Not all of this competition was on the above board basis, but we of Washington University in our graduating class decided that we would try to make the competitive examination which was held at the end of each school year for the senior classes, as fair as such an examination could be. We therefore determined that in the large room that had been set aside for the purpose at the City Hall, we would disperse ourselves around the room, allowing no men from any other schools to sit next to each other, and therefore we ourselves would be scattered and separated one from the other around the entire room. When some of the contestants discovered this form of seating, they quit the examination then and there. As a result of that examination, the great majority of internships in that year went to the Washington University graduates. Which we were called upon to treat in those days when Jesse Meyer was in practice: malaria and typhoid fever, along with tuberculosis, ranked among the first in order. Malaria was particularly prevalent in St. Louis, and at the city hospital practice, many cases of the falciparum type came in with hyperpyrexia and expired after a few hours in coma because of the massivity of the infection. Much of the typhoid fever was treated at the patient's home, and those patients who were hospitalized were taken care of as the practice of the day permitted in the city hospital. The admissions for typhoid fever were so numerous at certain seasons of the year that there were three wards set aside for that disease alone. Much of tuberculosis went unrecognized in its earlier stage before the employment of X-ray became widespread. typhoid fever showed a rapid retreat after the purification of the St. Mississippi River water supply, which had served St. Louis for the many years previous. The present system of water purification was initiated around the year 1903 and became perfected in the next several years. Following this, the importance of the milk supply as a spreader of typhoid fever became recognized. The infection coming from the fact that much of the milk shed in the rural districts was from typhoid-infested areas, and the washing and sterilization of the milk pails was of a most indifferent type, and pasteurization of the milk was not employed. Or at least not for some years to come in a uniform and thorough manner. Malaria disappeared after the lessons learned in the construction of the Panama Canal. It may be recalled that the first attempt at the construction of this canal came several decades earlier and had to be abandoned because of the tremendous toll from malaria and yellow fever among the working crews of the canal construction. It might also be recalled that the spirochete pallida, or treponema as it's now called, was discovered during the first couple of years of the century while I was in medical school, and that all the baffling problems of the later phases of the disease of syphilis were only gradually uncovered as a part of the remaining activity of infection. Previously, these later manifestations had been known as parasyphilitic, and the reason for their late appearance had remained quite a puzzle. so prevalent was the disease, and so protean its manifestations, that Osler once wrote that to know syphilis was to know medicine, meaning, of course, that the question of syphilis arose in the differential diagnosis of so very many diseases.